the floor session running over today, and therefore, it's the first time we're not starting this committee meeting on time, but I now open the House Subcommittee on Health Care Access of the House Committee on Health Care, and open a public hearing on HB 2850 and HB 3250. I think we can talk about them both together.
And we can start. Representative Maurer and Senator Monis Anderson were going to lead off 2850, but Senator Monis Anderson is in a committee, and we were going to come and get her if I had gotten a chance
to
see where you
wanted to
start.
Come and get her? Well, somebody ask?
Aaron went to get, but you might want, you can maybe bring.
Can we get Representative Maurer out of a committee to join us here? Oh, all right. Well, we'll take him. And the kickoff on
2850 is.
And this?
This is, they're later on.
Okay.
They're, great. But it will be Martin and Mary Lou after.
She'll get a representative off. Would you like to start?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Who are the committee sitting out there? But.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair and member of the committee. I've been reminded that being a freshman legislator and in the minority party, I should keep my expectations about influencing the legislative process in check. Fair enough. Today, then, I sit before you to contribute what I do know based on... Hello, ma'am. Based on my personal experience, I am the co-owner of a small, independent rural health clinic in Rogue River, Oregon, a city of about 2,000 people. Our office has been successful in large part due to the personality and expertise of my wife, Sheila, who is the other co-owner and a family nurse practitioner. She currently practices solo on a mostly full-time basis and is on call every hour of every day. In her spare time, she is also the Southern Oregon Regional Coordinator of the OHSU Nurse Practitioner Graduate Program. My role in the clinic is as a business manager, but my context is informed by my career in Army healthcare. Our clinic does not see very young children and infants, but our issues with government payment and bureaucracy are the same. From my point of view, the larger discussion about healthcare reform should evolve around or along two distinct paths. These paths are healthcare financing and healthcare delivery. I have sat through many hours of testimony and conversations in the Senate Healthcare Reform Committee, and the debate in this process is about healthcare finance. How is Oregon going to organize a healthcare system that covers every citizen, improves quality, and reduces cost? Clearly, this is a Herculean task at best, and then we must convince the people that this plan will achieve its primary objectives. We do have an advantage in this conversation with the public at large. Most people who receive health care services and pay health insurance premiums have come to the realization that the system cannot continue. However, the discourse has been relatively silent about the other path of health care reform, namely health care delivery. The Healthy Kids program is, in fact, an example of this. Before a few amendments were added, House Bill 2201 suggested the solution to the problem was more money to buy insurance in a system that we already know is terribly inefficient. That is, in part, why I'm not supportive of House Bill 2201 as it is currently financed, and no disrespect to my colleague in the Senate. I do applaud the amendments to the Healthy Kids program that reimburse local providers and add a nurse advice line, but I think it is really a tip of the iceberg. Along with health care financing, we need to move concurrently with new systems of payment for health services and reforms to the existing health care delivery system. If we do not do this, I think we should expect the publicly to rightly ask or to suggest that paying more money into a broken system is just not good public policy. What former Kitzhaber articulates in Senate Bill 27 is in many ways even more suggestive of the problem unless we reform the delivery system. Kitzhaber's proposal almost certainly means reallocating existing health care dollars among all people. For seniors, people with disabilities, and persons with complex medical needs, this may mean giving up benefits. I don't believe that the people will accept this unless we're able to show the people that we have a better way of delivering patient-centered care and in health and delivering health care on the whole costs less. House Bill 2850 represents to me, and what it represents to me, is a way to provoke conversations regarding the delivery systems reforms we most desperately need. This is a precursor to the type of changes we will need to make before we can realistically expect Oregonians to support a big plan to put everyone in a new healthcare system. Here is one of the most obvious observations about the current work of the Senate Healthcare Reform Committee. We talk a great deal about the flaws in the delivery system and the need for reform, but we never get down to details. Let me share a few details. Billing. In my clinic, about 20% of my personnel costs are directly associated with collecting money from patients, insurance companies, and the government, both state and federal. In my opinion, this is a waste to the system as a whole and does nothing to further the goal of providing efficient health care. The infrastructure that I am expected to maintain in order to access the payment system is complex and expensive. Multiply my issues hundreds of times by independent clinics across the state, and we begin to approach the magnitude of this disjointed system. There is a bright light at the state level. I am encouraged with what I've heard about the Department of Human Services Medicaid Management Information System, or MMIS. In this regard, we need to expect the next step, which is to cross the public-private chasm. For it is only when we standardize and simplify when we cross over the threshold to true health care reform. Next area is bureaucracy. If I can relate a short story from my years of experience with both state and federal government, I've learned that when a bureaucrat says, yes, that is no problem, what they really are saying is, yes, that is no problem for me. My clinic provides services to uninsured and underinsured women in the breast cancer cervical program, and by the way, it also includes men. This program is currently being administered by the county, in this case, Jackson County. Beginning this summer, the program is going to be administered by the state. The contract that I have with Jackson County is 4 pages long. The new contract with the state, which I will not sign, is now 40 pages long for the same program. Instead of moving toward efficiency and simplicity, this new contract moves radically in the wrong direction. And I just want to be clear that this is not necessarily DHS's contract, but as a requirement from Department of Administrative Services, DAS, they put requirements on DHS. So I do not want to point a finger at DHS in this circumstance. Now, you may ask why these things are important topics in relation to House Bill 2850. The answer is simple. House Bill 2850 isn't trying to solve the big picture. It is directing local communities to create a network of qualified and willing providers who will take on the responsibility of providing primary care for the children delivered where those children are actually located. It is a bill that can be amended, and I stress amended, to address the barriers providers face from even wanting to participate in this or any other state plan. It can increase provider access by taking in the real and practical issues providers face when they try to expand services or when they try to start up a new clinic. Let me get real specific about a few of the services that ought to be reimbursed in delivering care to children. These include school-based health centers, school nurses, community-based health clinics, including federally qualified health clinics, FQHCs, safety net clinics, and public health clinics. Home visits for at-risk infants by registered nurses through programs like Baby First and Cocoon. All of these point-of-contact services are supported by a nurse advice line that can assist families to take care for kids at home or direct them to the appropriate health care provider. Another landmark idea of House Bill 2850 is that these services should be organized at the community level into provider networks. We call these provider networks kid clinic networks. The provider networks will be promoted at the state and local levels so families will be as familiar with the kids clinic as they are with their local schools, fire departments, and emergency rooms. We want families to utilize primary care. Too many families don't know how to operate within the current insurance system, and as a result, they misutilize emergency rooms or simply do not access health care until preventable conditions become far more serious. We know that around Oregon, there are many innovative and remarkable programs that are already providing primary care to kids. We should not reinvent the wheel where it is already working. However, we shouldn't lose this opportunity to grow access at the point of contact of our children. So I'm here to urge you to develop the ideas reforming health care delivery as addressed in House Bill 2850. Any questions I will take at this time? Thank you.
Let's ask Senator Morris to answer first and then we'll ask both of you questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Senator Lori Moniz Anderson. I represent Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, and Fairview, Senate District 25, and I've been looking forward to being here today, testifying in support of legislation that will pair innovative changes to the delivery system with the Governor's Healthy Kids Program, House Bill 2201. And, of course, in my mind's eyes, we would have already passed House Bill 2201, and this testimony would be based on knowing that Oregon kids would have access to health insurance. So let me start there, the importance of health insurance for Oregon's kids. I spent the interim chairing the Senate Children's Health Committee. We met several times. And took testimony from scores of experts on health insurance, innovations from other states, as well as providers and citizens from around Oregon. And we came into this legislative session with the Healthy Kids Program, House Bill 2201, well vetted. And I, for one, am more than concerned that this has become a political football. But the starting point for any program to provide health care for all kids is a system of paying for health care. Insurance is the system. Once a vast majority of Oregon kids are insured, we have a way to pay for changes to the delivery system. This bill, House Bill 2850, is the kind of reform to the delivery system that is only possible when providers have the certainty of payment that the Healthy Kids Program allows. Let me describe the key ideas in House Bill 2850. The state will support services to children at the point of contact by allowing those providers to receive reimbursement from the Healthy Kids Plan. And I do know a thing or two about these services. I've worked in a school-based health center at Oregon City High School, and I managed public health services in the Clackamas County Health Department, and I was actually a public health nurse for the Multnomah County Public Health Department. We were the access to health care services many kids who didn't have insurance. And frankly, we were the health care services for many insured kids as well, because their parents were either unable or unwilling to navigate within their insurance plans. The thing that they had in common is that kids get services where providers are near them and their families. And let me give you some examples. I had many referrals from hospitals or from the WIC program or from Healthy Start. And there would be families in which they needed actually nursing care or needed help being referred. These were drug-addicted moms who had drug-affected babies, and therefore the babies needed monitoring in their home. We were able to provide those services in their home, monitoring nutrition, monitoring the health status, monitoring the weight. This was where the services were delivered. As far as in a school-based health clinic at Oregon City High School, we had a nurse practitioner that actually took care of those sore throats, the sprained ankles, the people that needed insulin injections and were not able to give them themselves. They are services. They were places where the services were actually being provided. The Healthy Kids Program is a great step forward, but it has a blind spot, and the same blind spot that is persistent in our insurance-based healthcare system. This blind spot is the assumption that insurance is the same as healthcare access, and that putting kids into insurance plans connects them to providers. But for many kids, the best way to connect them to providers is to reimburse those who are already in contact with them. The county health nurse, the primary care doc at the local federal qualified health center, the school nurse, or the Oregon Health Plan clinic run by the local hospital. My hope for the Healthy Kids program is that it becomes a starting point for universal health care for all people in this state. And I think for that to happen, it needs to be innovative. The current insurance-based health care system just doesn't work for too many people who are in it. I think House Bill 2850 starts to get at the questions of how do we deliver health care for kids in a way that everyone will agree is how they want health care, not for just kids, but for themselves. And I hope that you will take the time to develop this idea along with other innovative approaches like the bills you are hearing today. And I can't help but to also urge that you get House Bill 2201 over to the Senate so we can move forward with the important debates and discussions that follow. That was a political announcement. Thank you very much.
Are there any questions of these two fine witnesses? President McCann?
Thank you, Chair Greenlick, and thank you both for your testimony. Could you very specifically describe for us what the problem is, the particular problem or problems that this bill, not Healthy Kids, but that this creation of kids networks and requirement that I see in subsection 3 that primary care providers on the list provide care for kids, what are the specific problems that this bill 2850 is attempting to address?
From my view, thank you, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Cannon. In my view, there are services that are already being provided to children that are not being reimbursed. And I cited some of them in my testimony. As a public health nurse, we were actually giving health services, monitoring children, their weight, their nutrition in the homes. And that, of course, is not reimbursable. The clinic nurse at a school-based health center is not has the ability to reimburse. Now, some do, and I would think that other people in this room would be better able to describe the services that are paid and that are. But it's we already have a system that is working, there isn't a system or a network to reimburse those services that are already being provided.
If I may add. Thank you. What you're going to hear, some testimony a little later from the department that applies a huge fiscal to this, and that is correct. But I believe that this is an opportunity to begin to look at the system and to say, you know, this system just doesn't work. We need to rethink about how we finance, whether it's a managed care organization, a capitated organization, or regular indemnity insurance. And so this is an opportunity to start to say, where are those barriers? And let's start taking those barriers down. Because the problem is that in a lot of cases, we are not treating the kids, the children, where they are. We expect them to go someplace else. In many cases, that just is not happening.
If I can follow that. And the payment mechanism is that's in the in section 4, 5, and 6, right? 4, 5, and 6. Would you like a copy of the bill?
It's in the note.
Aaron, would you give him a copy of the bill?
Thank you.
There, 4 talks about reimbursing for somebody who, a kid who would be under Medicaid but isn't under Medicaid.
Actually, Chair Greenlick, it might help if we had Martin Taylor.
All right, well, let's. You can stay with him, or Senator Amaris Anderson, you need to get back to your committee.
I just want to hear this.
Okay.
Regarding reimbursement.
Mr. Taylor, how about you providing your testimony and then answering the question?
So for the record, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Martin Taylor. I'm representing the Oregon Nurses Association, and I have some testimony to give, but honestly, it should follow my member who is here to introduce the bill from ONA's perspective. I would like to answer this question right away, though, if it's okay. The reimbursement mechanism is really taking advantage of a universe where your children in the state should be covered in one of three ways. They'll either be insured through a Medicaid program that's enhanced through the Healthy Kids program, or they'll be insured through an employer-based health system, or they'll fit into this category created under Healthy Kids of having the ability to get a Healthy Kids insurance product where, depending on income level, they may receive a state subsidy. If you make the assumption that Healthy Kids passes and achieves its objective of getting most kids insured in one of those three ways, then what Sections 4, 5, and 6 of this bill do is essentially say that these providers are eligible to receive reimbursement from any of those three insurance products, the Medicaid insurer, the newly created Healthy Kids insurance product, or the commercial insurer. I think that some of the questions around the fiscal that you'll hear later will come into the question of in 5 and 6, it says that the department must reimburse the provider, and we'll be introducing an amendment, which has been alluded to, that will actually say that the managed care company will provide the reimbursement. Can I take just a minute to explain why that nuance is important?
You don't want to give any testimony, just want to give testimony.
Well, I don't want to overanswer the question, but at the same time, I think this is an important distinction.
Just be careful not to give any testimony while you're
on. I do want to be deferential to my member. Lori's a member, too, so I shouldn't say it, but to the member of our association who spent part of her day to come down here and testify to you. The amendment is intending to direct the reimbursement for Medicaid insured or kids on the Oregon Health Plan to go back to the managed care organization as opposed to from the department. This is really recognition that the department does not want to be issuing payments directly from the department, that those kids are already in an insurance product, so Care Oregon would be an example of that. But that's a capitated product. The difficulty there is that the Medicaid insurers have a right to expect that in a capitated plan you're seeing their providers. So what we're really doing to change that part of the system is saying, okay, the arrangement we have currently with our Medicaid insurers is that you pick your providers and they operate a capitated system, but now we have in this bill a end run of that willing provider statute. And the benefit to the public is knowing that there are places where your kid can go to get care. We can market that this is a point of contact where every kid that walks the door is going to get care. The downside is it probably will cause those managed care providers to renegotiate their contracts to the state at a higher rate. It'll be a smaller fiscal, and it will change the relationship between the Medicaid providers and the any willing provider expectation. But I think we believe that that's a good change.
Thank you. So you want to go away now?
Yes.
And I do have to get back to my
committee. You want to go away now.
But please call me back for the next bill.
Representative Maurer has to stay. Would you like to testify on the next bill right now?
Okay.
They're both open.
Okay. Oh, they're both open?
Mm-hmm.
On Senate Bill 3250?
Mm-hmm. House Bill 3250.
Sorry.
And we're even willing to open up an informational meeting on Senate Bill 562, which we don't have, so if you have testimony on that, you can do them all at once.
I only have a testimony for House Bill 3250 right now.
Please go ahead if you'd like.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Again, I'm State Senator Lori Montes Anderson, Senate District 25. And House Bill 3250, in a nutshell, it provides grants of up to $500,000 per pilot toward community health access collaborative efforts around the state. The problem is that existing delivery systems are fragmented, they're costly, and often unable to deliver coordinated, comprehensive care in a timely way. And fragmentation is compounded by the rates of underserved and uninsured Oregonians who experience significant barriers in accessing timely, affordable, and needed care. So, a solution is community health collaboratives. Nearly 20 of Oregon's 36 counties are reorganizing the way health care is delivered at the local level. And these collaborative efforts focus on increasing access to needed services, reducing disparities, and improving health care outcomes. Community health collaboratives involve a process by which consumers, providers, advocates, government officials, and other stakeholders understand and explore obstacles, differences, and alternative strategies for improving health. Community health collaboratives work in a coordinated, effective, and efficient way, which creates an ideal platform for bolder and more comprehensive reform. Community collaboratives connect the dots between individual and community health and respond to the confluence between cost, quality, and access. House Bill 3250 supports communities who are committed to reforming the local delivery system. That's why we would like to have grants. I think some counties are much more progressive than other counties or have the infrastructure to be able to do this. It supports Oregon communities so they may implement critical activities toward delivery system reform, such as outreach and enroll eligible people into publicly subsidized programs, provide culturally and linguistically competent medical homes, assure access to prevention and wellness services, provide affordable prescription drugs, assure access to specialty and hospital care, manage chronic diseases, coordinate comprehensive care, and develop strategies to cover low-wage workers. It encourages communities to work together to create innovation that will reform local delivery systems. This will help ensure access to needed health services that are delivered effectively, efficiently, and in a sustainable manner. And it incorporates an evaluation component. We're always looking at accountability, allowing us to learn more about what works and how to best support local innovations. It encourages and supports communities to ensure better health for more people at less cost. Health reform needs to be flexible enough to provide communities the opportunity to tailor their local service delivery systems to the needs and characteristics of their community. As policymakers need to expand health care coverage to Oregonians, House Bill 3250 supports community innovation toward meeting this goal in a way that is informed by local stakeholders and leverage community resources. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Senator Montes-Anderson, thank you very much. Let me preview where I think we're going with these bills. I've been meeting with some of the stakeholders over the last couple of weeks. I'm going to try and put together a small work group at the end of today's session that will look at several of these bills and see if they can combine them into a single omnibus.
That'd be great.
That might have a big fiscal, but at least we will know what we want in a single unified direction. So that's where I intend to go, and I hope you'll be willing to keep an eye on it along with
me. Would love. Just keep me informed. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You cannot go away, Representative Maurer. You have to stay. At least as long as you want to.
I can stay here all day. No.
Yes, that's what and I hope you will. I do want to also, as I said before, I'm sorry that I missed it, open up an informational meeting on the primary care home pilot projects as outlined in Senate Bill 562. We don't have Senate Bill 562. I think it's still in the Senate, right?
Yes.
But these ideas are very similar. Simone, I want to make sure we have a chance to hear it.
And then this is the panel for them, but these are the sign-ups for the bills.
Okay. I don't know what you're talking about here, so why don't you help me?
Okay. Where do you want to go?
Let's get a panel for each of them to start.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
These are the folks that will speak to the information.
We want Laura Sislak and Paul Logan.
And then Jane Ellen.
And Jane Ellen Wyden,
for the information
session. Come on up and talk to us about 562.
Sure.
And then we'll have, if I can,
and then you can switch
if them. I can figure things out. Oh, and there's also Martin Taylor and Mary Beth on this one when we're done. And then we'll go to. Okay. We'll work on it. Maybe we'll make sense out of this complicated approach today. And the problem is we've only got about 45 minutes now because we want to save 15 minutes for another bill.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Laura Sislak, the Director of Policy for the Oregon Primary Care Association, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to come and present to you regarding Senate Bill 562 on an informational basis to your committee, which is regarding our proposed primary care home pilot project legislation. Over the past year and a half, OPCA has worked with a number of partner organizations in a process that has resulted in this legislation. legislation and proposal. Following up on our successful policy forum in November of 2005, OPCA convened several work groups comprised of community and other organizational partners, in addition to our member health centers, to develop policy proposals addressing safety net capacity, the Oregon Health Plan, and health disparities. Those were issues that were raised in our November forum, and there was so much energy and sort of movement towards creating solutions and taking a look at what could be done in the 2007 session around those issues that we agreed to convene additional work groups to work on that. And this legislation is a result of that. Those work groups around the Oregon Health Plan, health disparities, and safety net capacity really all coalesced around this concept of a primary care home model. And so that's the legislation that you see before you today. I wanted to briefly touch on why we believe a primary care home is needed, sort of answering the question of what problem are we trying to fix, and then start to frame what we mean by a primary care home. The primary care home pilot project stems from a basic recognition that the healthcare system, including the primary care system, is broken, and financing systems for primary care currently emphasize a 10 to 15 minute patient visit, or less in some cases, and fail to support the really patient-centered care that results in improved health status. And I think Representative Maurer discussed that earlier around the children's system as well. In short, the system is fragmented, access to care is episodic, and patient and provider relationships are strained. And so continued investment in that system of healthcare delivery without fundamental change is simply not enough to reach our overarching goal of creating a sustainable healthcare system. And that's in part why we decided to take a look at reforming primary care delivery, and that this proposal was created. So what is a primary care home? I wanted to start actually by clarifying something that the primary care home is not. And despite the use of the term home, it is not a residential or inpatient program that we're talking about. The primary care home is a reformed and enhanced model of providing primary care delivery that would be provided through a traditional primary care provider or a safety net primary care provider. So it's in a recognizable primary care setting, but it's an enhanced and reformed model of delivering that care. We have a comprehensive definition that's included in the written testimony you have of a primary care home that includes the following features. The primary care home is the first point of contact to access care, so it's the first place where a patient would seek assistance and become linked with a team of health professionals. It's a place where they can identify their health care needs and access appropriate and culturally competent care. Number two, it's a place that develops sustained patient and family provider partnerships. So long-term relationships and a culture of trust are built between the provider team and the patient and family. There's a shared goal and shared responsibility for achieving optimal health between the provider and individual, and they work together to set patient health goals and to achieve those. The primary care home has comprehensive and integrated care, offering timely and convenient access either directly or by referral to a spectrum of medical, mental health, and dental services, an important component for many of our highest risk populations that I know a lot of rural health centers and community health centers serve is integrated behavioral health services. And finally, the primary care home acts as system navigation and coordination on behalf of the patient, assisting them to access the broader healthcare system as well as social and related educational services where necessary. So that's sort of the brief overview of the way we've defined the primary care home proposal. We think that these models should be flexible and tailored to meet the needs of the populations in every community. They will vary, based on the medical and social complexity of the patients served. And I know that Doug Riggs, whom we work closely with, has provided sort of a schematic to further help explain how the primary care home model adjusts systematically the primary care experience. So.
Did I call him up by mistake?
I think Paul Logan was unable to be here. And so.
He didn't look like Paul Logan.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Doug Riggs with the Oregon Primary Care Association. This is a complicated issue, and you can't describe what a primary care home would look like in all circumstances, but at 5 o'clock this morning, I attempted on my computer to come up with something that might be a pictorial reflection of maybe one type of current situation and one type of primary care home that you might face. So if you're looking at this sheet that I've handed out, and you're looking at the very top line, in many cases, if you're an uninsured Oregonian, this is what you see, and this is what you tend to do in the healthcare system. If you don't have insurance and you can't get into a primary care doctor, and you have a health condition, chances are you may end up in the ER. At the ER, you might get some sort of health treatment. You might be referred to someone else, but since you don't have insurance and you don't have any money to be able to pay for it, you go back to your house, your condition worsens, and you come back to the ER at some future point in time, and you go, your health condition may be much worse, and so you may require even more acute care. You might get referred to someone who you can't afford, so you go back home, and then eventually the cycle goes on and costs build up. So one potential pilot project could be what you see below, which might be a collaboration between a hospital and a primary care setting, a federally qualified health center, rural health center, et cetera, which would be designed to try to avert people from the ER and get them into a much more comprehensive system of primary and preventative care. And that's really what you see inside this green box. In this kind of a system, you would have some sort of a gatekeeper, a nurse practitioner, or a medical professional who might greet you, evaluate your condition, decide if you needed, you know, significant attention from a specialist or surgery or long-term care, in which case you might drop down into this lower portion of the box. Or they might decide that you might need either additional health care, maybe pharmaceuticals, maybe mental health treatment, dental treatment, prenatal, or healthier lifestyles and better conditions to manage your health care needs in a much more comprehensive manner. In both cases, the goal of the primary care home model is to get people into a continuity of care that's much more patient-centered and designed to have a shared responsibility between the patient and the healthcare providers. And then both the top and the bottom end up back in what we call case management, which we think is an integral part of this, which is you have someone at your medical home or your primary care home who is concerned about your overall health and can work with you over a long period of time to help result in better health outcomes. So they might help you with transportation to get you to and from the doctor. They might help with treating you better, healthier lifestyles. They might call you up to remind you that you have to have some sort of medical test on a regular basis or get you into some sort of treatment routine. And so the goal at the end of the process is that you're comfortable in this kind of a treatment. You feel like your needs are being met, that they understand your medical needs, and that you're much more likely to come back into a primary care home setting than you are to go to the ER at some future point. Now, obviously, this is a pretty simple schematic, but it's this patient-centered, holistic view of healthcare that we're talking about in Senate Bill 562.
Sorry, it may make sense conceptually, but artistically, it's pitiful.
You needed to get a limited artistic skill.
Are there questions, Doug? Representative Cameron?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Which of these two models is more costly?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Cannon, I think most of us would agree that the top model is much more expensive in large case because people do not seek treatment and preventative and primary care at the appropriate points in time. And so to the extent, and evidence shows this, the extent that you can get...
You have evidence on that?
Yeah, and Craig, I think, had some statistics that Laura referenced in her testimony as well about the percentage reduction in certain costs for especially chronic conditions if you can manage those chronic conditions over a long period of time. And I guess the other point that I make, Mr. Chairman, is what we're talking about here is really a collaborative process between not only federally qualified health centers or rural health centers and primary care docs, but it's getting the community involved, getting the local hospital involved, and trying to get everyone at the table, not unlike what you heard in House Bill 3250. And it's a similar concept, the concept that working together and collaborating on medical outcomes, you can improve the health outcomes for many patients in this state.
Can I follow up on that question?
Yes. And I kept my house, that it's more expensive, not less expensive. Yeah.
We don't have Senate Bill 562 in front of us.
We don't.
But it, according to the testimony, it envisions a total of $7.5 million in grant funds for a relatively small number of applicants. So this sounds like a critical question, but it's really just a sort of curious one. Why is that expenditure necessary to produce a model that ultimately is less costly?
Representative Greenlick, Vice Chair Cannon, we believe that this model has great promise for significant cost savings to the full system. I would agree, Representative Greenlick. This involves an added investment in the primary care side of providing health care, but we think that its ability to prevent long-term costs is extremely promising, and investing in these kind of model projects allows us to do a significant evaluation of the impact of these kinds of models and to really demonstrate the long-term outcomes that we think that we'll be likely to see. And I'll just really quickly...
So you're willing to put on the record now that if we fund a demonstration that comes out that it's more expensive to provide care than not to provide care, then you give the model up?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the intent is that we're trying to make sure that we're saving dollars long term through hospital admissions, emergency room visits, and so forth. Now, having said that, this change doesn't happen overnight, and some of the statistics that we've been sharing around models such as those experienced in Alaska, 50% drop in hospital admissions, 36% drop in ER visits, and so forth, took 4 to 6 years to realize. This is, a long-term investment in reforming the way care is being delivered to this population.
You have a total cost analysis for Alaska. Now they're actually spending all this money, actually came out spending less money in Alaska than was spent before?
We have those health outcomes documented.
Health outcomes, I'm talking about the total expenditures. When I asked the Alaskan people, they didn't have a clue.
I don't have their financial data, no.
There is the danger that providing care to people may cost more than providing not care, than not providing care. That's a danger we need to be prepared for. That may not be a bad outcome.
I understand.
Ms. Widens? You've been nice and silent there. Sorry?
I will wait until the...
Great.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee.
I'll give you a bell.
My name is Jane Ellen Widens, and I represent the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and I'm here today in support of this Senate bill and to testify about that. We believe that a medical home model makes sense for people. It provides quality care. It provides preventative care. It helps develop those relationships for people so that they know where to go. I think it was Senator Mona Sanderson who just said that providing access to care doesn't mean access to care. You need that relationship with your provider to be able to navigate the system, to be able to find the appropriate place to go. You need a gatekeeper who can help you define what's the best place for you to be and the best services for you to be access at that point. And we believe that this model and a pilot that will allow us to test that and see how it works in Oregon is actually a really good idea, and we support it because we don't want people just coming to the emergency room for primary care. We want our emergency rooms to be there for traumas. We want them to be there for critical illnesses and unforeseen events. We don't want someone who could be seen in a primary care for prevention of their diabetes or prevention of hypertension diseases and complications or even common diseases like strep throat. We don't want them coming to the ER for those unless that's the only option they have. A primary care model where they have access and continued relationship with a primary care provider we think is the best way to go. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You have a question now, or should we get some?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I do have several questions. First off, this is back to the medical home model. You don't envision this necessarily in one physical location. Is that correct?
Representative Maurer, Chair Greenlake, yes, that's correct. We're talking about 10 to 15 pilot sites and that these are coordinated services.
I'm sorry, let me rephrase the question.
Sorry.
In each location, you're not necessarily talking about having a primary care provider in the same building as a dentist, in the same building as a behavioral health specialist.
Representative Maurer, that may or may not be the case. In some providers, those are on-site services. In others, they may be through referral and coordinated care.
Follow-up, and the question is about capitation.
Keep rolling.
Just keep rolling. I would assume that the only way that this is going to work is through a capitated model.
Representative Maurer, Chair Greenlake, you're correct that the whole premise behind this is that the current fee-for-service investing in a short-term, time amount of visit is, we think, problematic. And so I think capitation is one potential direction. And part of the amendments we're planning or that we're working on for the proposal includes a pretty extensive evaluation of how financing systems should be modified to support the medical home if, in fact, outcomes are shown to be what we hope them to be.
Okay. Thank you. So that theoretically you might dump the CPT or common procedural terminology?
Theoretically,
thank you. And then to answer...
You might have a global budget rather than a sort of capitated budget. Mm-hmm. You could imagine something like that.
Okay. And then actually this is a follow-up about the cost. And I think that this is my theory, is that you will save money, but the controls are that you have to hold people accountable to their own personal health care so that they have to be compliant with taking their high blood pressure medications and taking care of their diabetes, but also at the ER, that they don't have that out to just show up at the emergency room without being held accountable in some manner for accessing it at what we would probably think is an inappropriate way.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if you factor in that accountability piece, I think that is where you're going to see your savings.
We'll see. Thank you very much.
Absolutely.
Is Commissioner Dick Scotton here? Oh, here you are, Dick. If you have one more elected, we'd be happy to honor you with that.
Thank you.
Then we have two people I think who've come from more than 100 miles. I want to bring them on after Commissioner Scotton to make sure that they have a chance. If I'm right about that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your courtesy and members of the committee. I'm here today to, first of all, let me identify myself, Dick Scouten on the Washington County Board of Commissioners, Washington County, representing the Beaverton Alhoa area. I'm also currently on the Tri-County Safety Net Enterprise and currently chairing it. And I'm very enthusiastic about House Bill 3250. I think it's a great bill. It provides for competition, a very competitive grant process. It's going to put an emphasis on programs that are innovative and collaborative. I'll confess that this whole field, unlike members of the committee and chair I'm thinking of in particular. This is a field that's relatively new to me. I had no idea until just a couple of years ago how very siloed so many of the efforts were, the clinics, the hospitals, the counties. I've also come to learn in the last couple of years in the event of going to a couple of conferences events that there's all kinds of collaboratives across this country that are doing wonderful things, very innovative, very entrepreneurial, emphasizing the private-public partnership piece, bringing people together and taking scarce resources and making them go a lot further. In Washington County, we have alone 60,000 people uninsured. I know we can do a better job in our collaboration. We can do a better job in our coordination with the other counties and the hospitals and clinics in the region. I was very impressed with what I've seen in efforts across the country, and I think this kind of money in this bill could seed and encourage people to continue or to start programs that can do that. In Washington County, we've always been very big on private-public partnerships. We've done a lot of human services and other county services with a private-public partnership concept. It works. It makes the money go further. It allows for innovation. I think this is just a real good bill, strongly supported, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Is there any chance we could leverage some Washington County money in this as well? That's a serious question.
Well, I know. Actually, one of the things...
We're spending a lot of money on health care.
One of the things that I like about this bill is that it speaks of this is a matching program. Currently, Washington County, on a couple of different ways, both in kind and services and dollars, have been very, very strongly supportive of the Tri-County Health Safety Net Enterprise. And I certainly do everything I can to put Washington County as a leader in this area. That's a promise I'll try to keep. But I like this matching program very much. It would encourage the people in my region to do that and find money out there. I would look forward in the next couple of years going out and trying to raise money for this for our collaborative effort. I'd love to do that. Thank you.
Say, how's your newest commissioner doing?
She's doing very well.
I hope I hadn't completely spoiled her.
No, I think you've trained her very well.
I have two people, I think, who have claimed to be more than 100 miles away, neither of which can I really read their names. Glenn Aubrey?
Glenna.
Glenna. Ah, there we go. And is it Aubrey? Yeah. Close there. And Shelley Smetana-Neon?
Smetana.
Ah, two names at the end, huh? What's Neon is who you're representing?
Uh-huh.
I got it now. Come on. Come on. Smetana I could have gotten. The Neon was confusing me. And they're both here to testify on 3250.
We are. I can't show
you. Ignore the glub.
Yeah, I know. I'd like to have some as well. First, I'd like to introduce myself. I'm Glenna Aubrey, and I am the executive director of the Area Health Education Center in Southwest Oregon. And I currently am sitting on the committee for SCRIPT, which is a collaborative health organization in Coos and Curry County. I've only been there for a few months. Before that, I lived in Eastern Oregon, and I was very involved with NEON, and which Shelley is going to speak about in a moment. And I think one of the things that I wanted to talk about first was when I first moved to La Grande, Eastern Oregon, I was given the position of Regional Health Insurance Coordinator. That was my title. And I had these great ideas of, we can do this and we can branch it out to Tri-County area and this will meet the needs of the folks there. What I found, it took me about 6 or 7 months really of traveling to these small communities in different counties. And we just weren't getting things done. And I started talking to people, and I mean, the programs were good. There was support, but we just weren't involving the citizens, really. And what I found was that it's really impossible for somebody on the outside to actually know the needs of these communities without that integrated working together hand in hand with the people that live there. And I was first involved with NEON. I had the opportunity to get involved in with people that are healthcare providers.
Can you tell us what NEON is, please?
NEON is, it's on here, ready?
The Northeast Oregon Network?
Yes. And NEON had, we had private employers, we had superintendents, we had just people from, you know, DHS, all kinds of folks that were very integral to the Tri-County region on this committee, and we would come together, and it was really amazing to sit, and we could talk about things that were kind of universal, lack of access to care, you know, transportation barriers, things like that. But at the same time, there were these individual components that even though I might live in one county, I didn't know about in another county because there were individual needs. But the people that lived in those counties knew those things. And we were able to come together in over a very short period of time, develop some pretty innovative ways to meet a lot of those needs. An example of that was simply that there were a lot of children in Baker County that didn't have access to dental care because there's not enough dentists there to do that. And yet there's a brand new dental school in LeGrand, the dental hygiene school. One of the members of the community or the committee said, well, I've got a van. We can do that. So what started happening was that these groups got together and started busing these kids and their parents over to get dental treatment. And that would have never happened had that group not come together. Script is doing some similar things. They're working on case management programs. And I think I would just encourage you not only to support looking at these grant programs to benefit local communities. I would also encourage you to get to know the people on these committees and in these communities, because they're going to be able to provide you with information that you're not going to get any other way. It's just impossible for somebody sitting here to know what rural communities need or even local communities that are kind of insular. So I would just encourage you to please not only support funding, the grant funding for these opportunities to continue and proliferate, but to also make an effort to get to know these people so that they can give you the best information that they can on what they actually need. Thank you.
Somebody on the committee asked the other day what an AHEC was. Can you give a 30-second definition?
I can. Area Health Education Centers, they're federal programs, state programs, and we get local funding as well. And there's a mandate through the AHEC to provide providers in the, what we do is the third-year medical students through OHSU currently, we provide homes and opportunities for them to do internships in very rural communities. We pay for that. We set those up and monitor that. We also do a lot of education, and I have a real emphasis on education for 12 through K. I mean, K through 12, getting these younger kids that live in these communities interested in health careers, and how can we facilitate that so that the students that already live there and are buying into those communities will have a place to stay and return to do practice. We know that it works much better for people that are already involved in those communities to provide service. That's what I think. Yes. You're welcome.
Yes.
Great. Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Shelley Smetana, and I'm the program coordinator for the Northeast Oregon Network. And I'm here today to support House Bill 3250 on behalf of NEON's members. NEON, as you know, is a community health collaborative that serves Baker Union and Molalla counties. NEON's members are diverse and represent mental health agencies, public health agencies, critical access hospitals, oral health care providers, service organizations, and county commissions on children and families across the Tri-County region. NEON's diverse membership allows us to address access to health care issues ranging from primary care to the so-called peripheral services such as access to mental health services, preventative health services, and prescription drugs. The health status of the residents of Baker Union and Molalla counties is much worse than in urban areas in Oregon. The Oregon Office of Rural Health estimates that nearly one out of every four Northeast Oregon residents does not have any form of health insurance. In addition, the residents of Northeast Oregon are more likely to live below the federal poverty level than their urban counterparts in the state,
and they make less money than their urban counterparts in the rest of the state. The region is highly isolated geographically. It can make traveling to healthcare specialists outside of the region highly difficult. And even for the residents of some of our most isolated communities, such as Troy in Wallowa County and Halfway in Baker County, even accessing a emergency room can be highly difficult, depending on weather and also access to a car and money for gas. Currently, as Glenna spoke to earlier, dental providers in Baker County are unable to accept new Oregon Health Plan clients. In addition, the emergency room of the hospital in Baker City is frequently accessed by patients inappropriately with oral health care needs. To address this access to oral health care problem, Neon partnered with the Oregon Dental Services School of Dental Hygiene and the local public transportation provider. And I use public transportation very liberally. It's a little van that drives around. Meals on Wheels, largely. And we are providing transportation to folks from Baker County to the School of Dental Hygiene in LeGram, where they can get free cleanings and preventive screenings. In addition, we're very excited to have recently received a grant from the Oregon Office of Rural Health to expand this program to provide reimbursement for folks' gas if they need to travel to an FQHC in either Ontario or Boardman to receive restorative oral health care services. And this this oral health care program has been an excellent example of how community collaboratives across the state are able to leverage existing resources to address real problems within the community. Hospital 3250 would be an incredible boon to community health collaboratives such as Neon around the state. It will provide an opportunity to access the necessary support for these collaboratives to continue to expand the good work that we are already engaged in. Grant dollars provided through House Bill 3250 could allow Neon and other community collaboratives to continue to involve diverse stakeholders in community-based solutions. In addition, the bill would allow communities to leverage the resources that we have worked very hard to raise. Last, it will allow community-based efforts such as Neon to deliver more effective and efficient health services in a sustainable fashion. Thank you very much, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. You should know that we didn't talk. I didn't know she was going to talk about that, the dental van, so that's good.
You're great. I need to tell you, I worked with the Southwest Alabama Health Center that was creating a health center in one of the three poorest counties in the United States, and they identified the need for transportation and ended up working on it so sufficiently that they had the second largest public transportation system in the whole state by the time they were done.
Mr. Chair, I was going to suggest that we need to look into getting some light rail out in Baker County.
I mean, Baker County prides itself on the covered wagon.
It's true. It is true.
That's a great tradition. The tracks are still there, right?
Yeah, they are.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I have Martin Taylor looking like he's supposed to be in two different panels to start, and I have you and Mary Lou Henrich and maybe Mary Beth Healy, if she's here, on two different bills. So, Martin, are you about ready to give testimony? If Mary Lou does it first, can you?
You are first.
Oh, I'm first. Okay. Chair Greenlich and committee members. Oh, here's all my... I even wrote something for you guys.
I've been seeing a lot of you lately.
Well, that's the way it is. Public health nurses, we get around. My name's Mary Lou Henrich, and I am, for the record, I am a public health nurse and currently serve as the Executive Director of Community Health Partnership, Oregon's Public Health Institute. I'm here today, however, as a member of Oregon Nurses Association Cabinet on Health Policy. I'll give you a little bit of my background because I think it will help you kind of understand kind of how I see the world, which is pretty holistically. As some of you know, I've been active in local and state public health service delivery and policy for nearly 40 years. This is really getting kind of embarrassing. I had a 30-year career at Multnomah County Health Department, starting as a district public health nurse in Northeast Portland in 1969,
And over the years, ultimately supervising, managing, or directing nearly every field and clinic health program, including public health nurse home visits, family planning, WIC, prenatal care, starting school-based health centers, and primary care clinics. In 1994, Multnomah County and OHSU and federally qualified community and migrant health centers around the state collaborated to form Care Oregon. I was the founding CEO of Care Oregon from the beginning of the Oregon Health Plan in 1994 until 2003. Then I returned to my roots in public health as executive director of Community Health Partnership. So you might say I've been there, done that. I have a somewhat unique position as a nurse, home and clinic-based public health care provider, director and administrator of numerous community-based health services focusing on low-income children and families, a managed care health plan suit, and now a public health policy advocate. It is from these various experiences that I address you today. I find that when we get into discussions such as we are having today, and actually it came up a little while earlier, we often use the words health and health care interchangeably. The two are connected, but they are not the same. So that's why you've been seeing me on House Bill 2650 talking about health and the environment and making nutritious foods available, because that's really getting at health. That's not health care. But health care and health are linked, and if health care is good and appropriate and culturally relevant and all those things you're hearing about, hopefully it can help us get to a healthier state. But I do kind of go nuts with people when everybody just kind of talks about health and health care as if they're the same thing. We also talk about insurance and access to health care also kind of interchangeably, as if you have a card, then you've got access to care. And I think what you're hearing today from a variety of sources is that isn't always the case. It helps in some, but not all circumstances. And the two aren't exactly the same. I also forgot to tell you that I'm on the board of directors of the Oregon Health Action Campaign. And in this role, I'm frequently reminded that access and insurance are intertwined, but not one and the same, especially for children. So what I think that Martin and Oregon Nurses Association want me to do today is talk a little bit about how we got to where we are and how ONA in our health policy cabinet really talked about these issues as they relate to kids. We are strongly supportive.
I'd also like you to talk a little bit.
A little bit, okay. Strongly supportive of Health Care for Healthy Kids Initiative 2201, but we did realize it isn't the end point, that the delivery system, the way things have kind of been built and kind of like the house that Jack built is what we've got here, and so to simply have more of it and pay for it and have everybody have access to it, it isn't going to really solve our problems in getting children healthier and even getting them better and more continuous health care. So this is the point that I think you will hear others today, and I'll reference a little bit about, for example, that point of service that Senator Mona Sanderson was talking about, the public health nurse home visit, for example, the school nurse visit, the school-based health center, those places where kids interact with that first point and contact of a healthcare professional who can help figure out what's wrong, figure out what's needed, give sometimes information or screenings that can take care of the problem without going any further, sometimes has to go on to a physician or to a specialist or sometimes to a hospital. Those pieces have been funded over the years with, you know, bubble gum and wrappers of things and put together with grants and fundraisers and begging and county general fund and you name it. And it seems to me that ultimately if we are going to really fund health care for all kids, we need to step back a little and take a look at, is the best way to have public health nurse home visits, and you'll hear later about Babies First and Cocoon, to be funded every year, hoping that the little bit of general fund will make it into the ways and means process, get to the state and come out to the counties, and then they'll do some billing of Medicaid that will get some reimbursement for it. But if kids have private insurance, that's not covered. And it's just, in my mind, time to say, we had to do it this way before. There was no other option. But if we are really going to have a system that says we're going to try to make kids healthier by having them have really good and continuous health care, we've got to step back and look at school-based health centers, public health nurse home visits, things in safety net clinics. And I've been there. My husband has said to me, Mary, how is it after all these years you continue to kind of inch forward while $1 million is dropping out at every turn? And I said, because we are running so fast trying to find something to fill the gap of what's being dropped out, but we never really get ahead and really ultimately do what I think the system can do. So that's the rest of my stuff is you can read, and I will now leave it to Martin to pick up all the pieces.
Thank you. I just want to alert where we're going from here, and since we started late, I feel comfortable going until 5:15 if that works all right. The next panel, I'll ask Linda Fleming, Patty Vega, and Sue O'Mell for a panel. Then I'll ask Rick Wopat, Tracy Brado, and Laura Brennan. And if Jim Edge still needs to talk, Jim, you think? Fine.
I can just have mine in if you'd like.
Well, we'll see.
You don't have the large fiscal, that's what I'm going to say.
Well, we figured that one out. But we can do you and Ellen Lowe to start, anchor the final panel. You can talk about how much money it costs, and she'll talk about how important it is. Martin?
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, thank you very much for this day. Again, it's Martin Taylor representing the Oregon Nurses Association. I'm here representing about 11,000 nurses in this state, including Mary Lou, who I appreciate taking some time today to be down here. Our chair of the County Health Policy, Kelly Taylor, is also in the room, and obviously Senator Moss Anderson's a member, so we've been well represented today. But I think the thing that's most relevant about House Bill 2850 is that very few ONA members actually are going to be the providers that are expressed in this bill. For collective bargaining, we primarily represent hospital nurses. We have some county health nurses that could potentially be kids' clinics, but most kids' clinics are probably going to be small providers. We don't represent folks in FQHCs. We don't represent very many folks like Representative Maurer and his wife, Sheila. We don't have the kind of stake in this that you normally would look at and say they're a financial stakeholder. Where the Oregon Nurses Association started its process is we said we believe in the concept of universal health care. And taking on something that big requires smaller bites. Let's start with kids. Kids are an affordable group to insure because they're relatively inexpensive because they're fairly healthy. Kids are sympathetic to the public. And there's a greater sense of public obligation to our kids because kids that happen to be in families that don't provide for them well don't really have another choice. They can't say, boy, I'm four and I'm leaving this family for a better one, right? That's why we accept some of the societal responsibility for kids. So that's where we started. And assumed that we were talking about how to insure all kids. I think that's the same assumption that the Healthy Kids Program made, and that's why it's in front of you. I think that what we learned in three or four work groups of nurses, primarily hospital nurses, but we drew upon expertise around our membership, including our nurse practitioners and the Mary Lou's and others, was that actually if you were going to start from whole cloth, you wouldn't achieve universal health care for kids by insuring everybody. You'd do it by reimbursing the folks who are already there providing services for the kids, but there's too few of them in number. A school nurse is not reimbursed and is not an insured provider. Most school-based health centers are not reimbursed. County and public health nurses, the visits that public health nurses make to homes of at-risk infants, that's not a reimbursed service. In other words, you have a delivery system for the uninsured where some access for kids takes place right now, but it's not based on a reimbursement model. And in fact, if you were going to try to get services to kids, you try to expand the number of providers who are already at a point of contact with those kids. You wouldn't start by insuring everybody and driving the traffic towards insurance panels. Another way of saying that is the difference between Healthy Kids and what we're putting in front of you is that Healthy Kids essentially says, let's take the population of kids who don't have services and not put them in contact with the school nurse and school-based health center. Let's drive them to a group of folks who are in an insurance panel, which probably are not in the proximity of the kids. They're unlikely to be at the point of contact. Now, that's a very helpful thing. Healthy Kids is a very helpful thing no matter how you do it. A, it's better than any program that we've ever had in the state. It is a huge step forward. And B, at the point where every kid has a payment attached to them, you have the ability to go back to your delivery system and say, okay, now that the kids come with reimbursement, who ought to be reimbursed? And the answer to that question is, the people who ought to be reimbursed are the ones that are at the point of contact for kids, because kids are less likely to be able to say, I'm going to leave middle school today because my throat hurts, and go find my insurance provider. They may go to their school nurse if they've got one, and most don't. And in 45 cases in the state of about 2,000 schools, we've got a school-based health center. But for the most part, the sick, you know, kid at age 4 is going to depend on an adult to get them into an insurance product. And that's where the system breaks down for a lot of kids. There isn't a responsible adult in their environment. So that is the general theory of this bill. The general theory of this bill is that you should drive traffic towards the point of contact with kids. Our vehicle for doing that is to create what are called kids clinic networks. Kids clinic networks say, we originally started with just kids clinics, which is a lot like the primary care home concept, only just for kids. And then recognize that there were a lot of providers, of course we're thinking nurses, but a lot of providers who have contact with kids who aren't working out of a clinic. The nurse that does a home visit isn't necessarily working out of a clinic. The school nurse isn't necessarily working out of a clinic. So it's a clinic network. You want to have a clinic that people know that they can arrive at, but you also want to be a network of services that go out when necessary into the homes or into the schools. And to say the relationship between that clinic and the community would be, if you agree to take 100% access for primary care for the kids in that community, as the state, our deal with you is we'll make sure that you get paid for every contact. And the way you're going to get paid for every contact is if you accept that designation, we'll make sure that you get reimbursement from Medicaid, from the New Healthy Kids Program, and from the commercial insurers. Now, what you're going to hear is that that might cost some money. A, if that's the best way to deliver care for kids, we ought to be willing to pay some money. And B, the fact that it might cost some money might actually be a little bit more of how do we want to spend our money. We have Medicaid insurers right now who are paid in our managed care capitated system where there is payment attached to them. It is coming from the state dollars, but it's for the providers in that managed care's panel. So if what we're trying to do is say, well, if there are willing providers who are going to grant 100% access to the same people that were already paying for their care, isn't there some way that we can work out in these Medicaid contracts that that reimbursement should take place? In other words, shouldn't those providers also be in on the goal of getting everybody a place, every kid a place they can go to get care? And I'm very happy to work with the Medicaid providers in the state to figure out how to make that work, but I think that there's a way that we don't have to pay for all these services twice. That's my bottom line. That is the nut of this plan. Now, there's five characteristics I want to talk about. The point of service I've talked about. The 100% access I've talked about. The certainty of payment I've talked about. The fact that these ought to operate in something similar to the primary care home model that has been described in 562 is a concept that we've advanced, and that means follow-up case management, and it means, and the bill's amendment will do it, that you ought to be enrolling kids in an insurance product if they show up uninsured. Assuming Healthy Kids passes, every kid should have access to an affordable insurance product, and if they aren't, it means that they have adults in their lives who have not gone through the effort to put them in the Medicaid program, and they ought to be doing that at the point of service. And finally, that we want to build off community and local infrastructure. I think that the commonality between these bills is exceptionally high, that these community collaboratives tell us that in many places, uninsurance does not mean you don't have access to health care. In many communities, you have folks who are providing access to health care to the uninsured. They're doing it on a community level. They're doing it on a voluntary level. But we ought to grow those things, not try to supplant them or replace them. Those are the things that work. And we don't want to come in and say to the things that work, we're going to graft some different system on top of you that ignores the fact that you're already doing something that works. So creating a set of kids clinic networks or the grassroots that build off of those programs is a better approach. And that's why we start with four startup counties where you're telling local communities, you tell us how you want your provider network set up and what services you want included. We're not going to tell you as the state how to do it. We are going to create a reimbursement structure that will allow you to do it under the existing system. I know Mitch is looking at the clock, which is my cue that I'm supposed to shut up. I was going to say a little bit about primary care homes, which we support, and community planners we support, but I will wrap it up because I know that. Thank you. Questions? Sorry.
Thank you very much. Questions? Martin knows how to get a hold of all of us, so.
Hey, I'll see you, most of you, later tonight downstairs.
Thank you. I don't have a question. I do actually have lots of questions, but this has helped a lot.
Yeah, this
presentation has helped my understanding of the bill, so thank you both.
Yeah. Okay, Linda?
You have two and not three?
Mr. Chair, Patty Vega had to leave. She has children she had to pick up from school, I believe.
She's
so
the mother of twins.
She's the mother of twins. But we did submit her her written testimony, so you'll be able to see that. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Linda Fleming. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Coalition of Local Health Officials. We represent Oregon's 34 local health departments. I'm here today on the behalf of the coalition saying we support House Bill 2850 with amendments to include public health nurse home visiting services as a reimbursable health service for children and a part of the provider network to be established around the state. Amendments to that effect, I believe, are going to be introduced by the Oregon Nurses Association, and we've worked closely with Martin Taylor, Mary Lou, and other people at the association, and have found it to be a wonderful partnership and relationship, and I've enjoyed it greatly this legislative session. I am going to refer to this and would encourage you, as you look at those amendments, to use the term public health nurse home visit services versus mentioning any specific service model. And I have a couple of reasons for saying that. First of all, when you refer to them as public health nurse home visiting services, it clearly states what you're talking about. Using the program names Babies First and Cocoon does not really clearly state what it is we're talking about. In addition to that, research and evaluation over the years may change and indicate that to keep up with changing trends and to be on the cutting edge, we might want to change the model of service. And we would not want to be locked into statute into a very narrowly defined set of service models. So that's why I'm referring to this public health nurse home visiting services. One of the things I want to clarify is what makes public health nurse home visiting services different from other home visiting programs. And I want to specifically thank Representative Richardson for bringing this question to my attention. Mary Lou and I traveled down to Central Point last fall to visit with Representative Richardson and talked to him about public health nurse home visiting. And one of the questions he asked, well, you know, what is different about this from all of the other services? Mm-hmm. And it was that point that I realized that the Department of Human Services and the Coalition of Local Health Officials, quite frankly, has done a lousy job in several legislative sessions of clearly identifying what is different about public health nurse home visiting services. So I hope today, Representative Richardson, I can do a better job of clarifying that for you. First of all, these services are provided only by registered nurses that are currently trained in the public health models of Babies First and Cocoon. They are an extension of the primary care system. Referrals are received from physicians, like pediatricians, neonatal intensive care units, hospital nurseries, pediatric nurse practitioners. These are referrals received from other health care providers. They are referring to public health nurses for a supporting health service for their plan of care for that child, similar to referring to physical therapy or referring to the pharmacy department or the X-ray department. They're referring to a public health nurse because they want supporting health services provided to that child in the home. The infants and young children have identified medical conditions, risks, and or diagnoses that require interventions by a licensed healthcare professional. And I've attached for you in my testimony, I'm not going to go through it, but I've attached for you the eligibility criteria. And I think if you peruse that criteria for infants and children referred into Babies First and Cocoon, it's very clear that these are kids with medical conditions. These are kids that need to be seen by licensed healthcare professionals, and that's what makes this home visiting service different from some of the other services. How many children actually receive these services in Oregon? The latest data that I've received from the Department of Human Services for fiscal year 05-06 records 9,176 individual clients in Babies First receiving 33,063 visits, and during that same time frame, another 1,362 individual clients in Cocoon received 4,882 visits. These infants and young children are some of the most vulnerable children in the healthcare system. They and their families need support and care in the home beyond what they receive in the hospital and in that 15 or 30-minute visit at the doctor's office. The physician relies upon this service for feedback and assistance so that the course of care he has for that child will lead to successful successful outcomes. We are asking that you please make public health nurse home visiting a sustainable effort, a sustainable service in this state by including it in the packages of care services available to all infants and children meeting the criteria and in need of such services. Thank you. I would also add, Representative Greenlick, that I traveled here today from Fossil.
No, I've been to Fossil.
I know you have, the Bluegrass Festival.
The Wheeler County Bluegrass Festival, yes indeed. I have the T-shirt to prove it. Please.
Representative Greenlick and committee members, my name is Sue O'Mell. I'm a public health nursing supervisor with the Washington County Health Department, Health and Human Services, and I'm here also to...
You have to be careful, one of your bosses.
I know that. I'm here also to support House Bill 2850 with amendments, which would add public health nursing home visits as a reimbursable service for children. My staff of 9 FTE public health nurses make home visits to medically high-risk infants and infants and toddlers with special health care needs. As Linda mentioned, the majority of our referrals come from local hospitals and from the neonatal intensive care units at Emmanuel, OHSU, and St. Vincent's Hospitals. About half of the referrals that we receive each year are for preterm babies. The rest of them are for babies with birth defects, genetic or metabolic disorders, birth injuries, health problems related to the newborn period like respiratory distress, infection, sepsis, withdrawal from substance use of the mother. We see babies with developmental problems, and we also see a vast majority of babies with, they're referred for feeding problems and failure to thrive. Over the last couple of years, we've seen a growing number of babies referred who are called late preterm babies. These are babies that are born at 34, 35, and 36 weeks. And in many cases, the healthcare system treats them or their parents treat them as if they're normal newborns, when in reality, these babies are 4 to 6 weeks premature. These babies are at very high risk for medical problems in the newborn period also. And again, respiratory distress, sepsis, jaundice, dehydration. These babies are frequently sent home quickly and are often readmitted to the hospital within the first 2 months of their life. In Washington County, we have targeted these babies as a priority group and provide an active public health nursing management program, which includes frequent weight checks, feeding assessments, and very active management of breastfeeding and other problems in an attempt to reduce the problems that I just described. I want to take just a second to tell you about one child that I saw. I'll call this child Annie. Annie was born at 36 weeks in a local hospital, weighing about 5 pounds. Her mother's labor was induced because her mother was developing rapidly increasing high blood pressure, which is a common cause of these early deliveries. I think I said about 5 pounds when she was born. She went to the neonatal intensive care unit shortly after birth for respiratory distress. She was dismissed from the hospital when she was 4 days of age. I saw this baby when she was 6 days of age. I weighed her, and at that time her weight was about 10% less than her birth weight, which is sort of a critical cutoff point. And at that point, I began the interventions that I just described. I took the mother a breast pump. This mother was very committed to breastfeeding this infant and taught her how to use the breast pump every 3 hours throughout the day and the night. I instructed her on how to wake and feed this baby every 3 hours throughout the day and the night. And showed her how to breastfeed the baby, taught her how to latch the baby, and shared the tricks of the trade around how do you feed a sleepy baby who really is not particularly interested right now in feeding. I visited this family every day or every other day for the first week after the baby came home from the hospital. By the second week of this baby's life, her birth weight had returned, or her weight had returned to her birth weight, which is the goal that we are hoping to accomplish. I also talked frequently with this child's pediatrician, and we coordinated our plans of care for this child and her family. I believe that these nursing interventions reached my three goals, which were to prevent a rehospitalization because this child was at high risk, to prevent this child from developing the kinds of problems that children can develop, like dehydration and jaundice, and finally to sustain the mother's breastfeeding. And in fact, this mother did go on to exclusively breastfeed this child until she was at least a year old. This is an example of the kind of service that we as public health nurses are providing to families. Public health nurses are a very important component of the healthcare system, but as you've heard, the nursing services are not reimbursable under current public or private insurance plans. House Bill 2850, with the amendments, would recognize and financially support the contribution that public health nurses are making to infants and their families and to the healthcare system. Thank you for this opportunity to testify. And I would also.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Thank you very much for coming. Dr. Wolpat, Tracy Brado, Laura Brennan on 3250.
And
he's not crossed off.
He's not.
Grant, you still around here? I saw him a bit ago.
He's there.
Okay, we'll end up with Jim and you and Ellen Lowe in the next panel. I had you crossed off the list, Grant. Right?
Guys. Representative Greenlake, Vice Chair Richardson, and members of the committee, thank you. For the record, I'm Rick Wolpat, and I'll be very brief. I'm a family physician from Lebanon, here to speak in support of 3250. I'm going to briefly speak a little bit about what I consider to be the issues and my judgments and how I think you can be of help to us in solving some of the problems related to health care. First, I want to recognize Representatives Greenlake and Richardson for their leadership on health care and understand that you guys sit around and listen to this for many hours and apologize for keeping you here.
So do you.
Yes, I do, I think. In essence, the good news is that there's a lot of momentum around health care reform. The bad news is if we had universal access and universal coverage tomorrow, we wouldn't have universal access. We wouldn't have the ability to care for everybody that needs health care in our state. That said, I think the only way we're going to solve that problem is to restructure the health care system. And my belief system is that that has to be done on a local basis. It can't be done on a one-size-fits-all across the state of Oregon. In the seminal book, Crossing the Quality Chasm by IOM, they say the current systems will not solve the problem. We have to, trying harder will not work. We need to change the system of care. So there's two separate questions. First is, how do you care for everyone? The second is, how do you restructure the system in a way that improves, gives us better care for our communities? I have a couple judgments that I need to share for you to understand where I come from. First judgment is, in a resource-limited economy like healthcare, where there's a limited number of resources and potentially unlimited demand, cooperation, collaboration works better than competition. I believe that, and at least in the region where I practice, I think that has been shown to be true. The second judgment is that all solutions are local. That what works for me in Lebanon, Oregon, or in Sweet Home, Oregon, or in Corvallis, or Lincoln City, or Newport, doesn't work well in Portland, or Medford, or Burns. So that said, what's the role of the legislature? My belief is that the legislature is really a tool for creating environments where good things can happen. And the way in doing that, you have to be good stewards of the state's resources, both financial and human. So I'm here requesting that you invest some of the state's resources in stimulating local health system research and development, R&D and healthcare delivery. HB 3250 is a framework in which the state can serve as a environmental engineer. It's a stimulus to the system to create collaboration. I'll use a quick example, that being that the DHS has some grants on chronic care management, and one of the ways that has helped us is it stimulated a cooperative, collaborative effort between Linn County, Benton County, Lincoln County Health Departments, and Samaritan Health on how we can better structure chronic care. So, you've heard several examples of what communities can do, and working together, collaborating is hard work, and sometimes a little money from the state goes a long way to bring people together. In closing, I'd like to read you a short paragraph from Don Berwick's book called Breakfire. Don is the head of the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, and I would consider a champion of change in the system. And he has spoken to 13 of the IHI's national meetings, and this book is his 13 talks, and he says all about how he's changed. His hair's all turned white, he's blown out his knee, he's gotten older, so he looks back over his speeches and he says, "With so much different, why do these speeches strike me as so repetitive? Metaphor after metaphor, list after list, story after story, but always the same. Year after year, I can only find three messages at the core. Those three are focus on the suffering, build and use knowledge, and cooperate. There is no other suggestion in these pages. All else is fluff and padding." So that's what I'm asking you to do here today. Help us, give us a stimulus to cooperate, to build and use knowledge on how to do it better and how to focus and reduce suffering. Thank you.
Thank you. The only lesson I'd add to that is, I may have heard Don say this, is if something can't possibly happen, it's not likely to. Who's next?
Mm-hmm. Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tracy Grotto, and I live and work in Multnomah County.
It's a G and not a B, huh?
Yes, it's bad writing. No, I'm sure that was my fault. I'm the executive director of the Coalition of Community Health Clinics, which is a 21-year-old collaborative of safety net clinics in Multnomah County. We were a program of Multnomah County Health Department for about 19 years, and as the economic and healthcare environment changed so significantly, both I think at the national, state, and local level, the clinics decided to really push the envelope and spin off that program from the health department. The coalition, in the last year, its member clinics have grown to 5 federally qualified health centers and 9 community-sponsored clinics. And those are the clinics that generally are supported by local resources, leverage the volunteer services of the community. Collectively, they've provided about 30,000 or 181,000 services to about 30,000 low-income and uninsured. We are one example that is, I think, a community-driven response to the need. We do not represent a broad base of stakeholders. However, our partnerships do. We partner with, as I said, the Public Health Department, health promotion and prevention agencies, hospitals, mm-hmm. pharmacies, local foundations, on and on. The impact that this bill, House Bill 3250, would have on our local community is really to take a very complex and competitive system and help us organize it in a better way. I think this bill provides the expectation that the local communities do the heavy lifting, both financially and around the delivery services to care. And that excites me because I think we need that pressure at the local community to respond. I think Portland's done a good job, or Multnomah County and the Tri-County actual region has done a good job at responding. We've created some particular access initiatives around organizing donated medical services. We've improved our interpretation services programs. We've got a medication assistance program that focuses on getting the getting those resources to the clinic so they can be the deliverers of care. Our clinics are all very diverse in who they serve and who they represent, both from cultural, linguistic, access abilities. We need to do a better job, I think, at, I think what Rick was saying, demonstrating what those outcomes are and doing that sort of research and evaluation. And that's where I think this framework really gives us a pathway and a direction to go that everyone can wrap their arms around. So thank you for hearing my testimony today.
Thank you very much.
I get no respect. Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Richards, and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Laura Brennan. I reside in Portland, Oregon, and I work as the Community Development and Policy Director for Pacific Source Health Plans, and I'm also the Executive Director of Pacific Source Charitable Foundation. Pacific Source and I have the honor to serve nearly 20 counties around Oregon who are trying to reorganize the way that they deliver services, making sure they're building effective, efficient, and sustainable systems. I was wondering, I'd love to submit my written testimony. Mike Bonetto, who is the chair of the Central Oregon Health Collaborative, was unable to be here. I have his testimony, and I was wondering if I could bypass mine, just hand that to you and read his. Would that be okay?
How about bypassing yours and summarize his?
Got it. It's a deal. So if Mike's watching now, I hope I'm making him proud. For the record, I'm reading Mike Bonetto, chairman of the Central Oregon Health Collaborative, also the vice president of the Business Development and Government Affairs for Clear Choice Health Plans. He's the chairman of Deschutes County Public Health Advisory Board, and he's a board member of the Volunteers in Medicine Clinic of the Cascades. He apologizes that he's unable to be today at today's hearing. On behalf of the Central Oregon Health Collaborative, I am pleased to submit this testimony in support of House Bill 3250. We believe that state action is warranted that would provide modest funding to help move local communities forward in creating a more sustainable system that produces better health for more people at less cost. Central Oregon Health Collaborative's mission is to develop and implement strategies that improve health through active engagement of the Central Oregon community. At this time, the Central Oregon Health Collaborative sees no viable, comprehensive federal or state policy that would improve the health of our citizens by creating a sustainable system. We believe local innovation that is responsive to the unique environment, populations, and infrastructure is an imperative solution, and therefore we have assembled a steering committee of business and community leaders to lead a region-wide initiative. House Bill 3250 would provide a starting point for the state to invest in such local collaboration. The Central Oregon Health Collaborative began as a concept nearly 2 years ago and has evolved. We have applied for a 501c3 status and have been awarded a $20,000 grant from the Central Oregon Partnership, a $10,000 grant from Providence Health Plans. With these funds, it is the Central Oregon Health Collaborative's intent to hire a part-time coordinator by May 1st. This position is critical for the Central Oregon Health Collaborative to move forward. This initial funding is a positive step forward. However, we believe a commitment from the legislature could expedite efforts around the state to better understand effective models for delivery system reform. We recognize that successful healthcare collaborations involve a process by which citizens, providers, advocates, government officials, and other stakeholders understand and explore obstacles, differences, and alternative strategies for improving health. We believe it is in the state's best interest to pass House Bill 3250 and begin supporting local collaboratives so that we can begin restructuring local healthcare delivery systems to produce better health for more people at less cost. Sincerely, Mike Bonetto. Dr. Bonetto.
Nice job. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Are there any questions? Okay. One more panel. Do let me announce before everybody disappears that I am asking a work group to get together that will start meeting twice a week, Thursday and Tuesday at
1 o'clock. We'll let you know the room for about 2 weeks to see if we can put together the best things out of 3250 and 2850 and anything else we have. We have several bills that are all trying to get to the same thing. We have a feeling if we can get it together into a single bill, get a fiscal, which we expect will not be a small fiscal, but at least we can all know what we're working on and we can all be aiming for. And I'd like, I've asked either Sandy or Rick Bacobian, they'll work out to staff it. Who else have we got? Somebody from Care Oregon, Pam or Emily, whoever. Doug Riggs, Ellen Pinney. Joel Young has been asked to join us from DHS. Jane Ellen for the Hospital Association. Craig Hostetler, Martin Taylor, Laura Brennan, and I've asked Representative Maurer to join as well. Rick, if you'd like to fool around on that, you're welcome. If you have the time, we assumed you might not quite have the time to do that, but it would be great. Somebody else. It would be nice if we get Lori Freeman to join us, at least to sit in on some of it, so we have an LC handy because it's going to be a problem. We have until the end of April to get all the House bills taken care of, so that means we really do need to have this done in about 2 weeks if we can move it before we have to deal with the craziness of Wilson first. My dad used to sing me a song, Ellen, from his childhood. I'm a lonely little petunia in an onion patch. It's fitting very nice. How about you starting, please?
Chair Greenlich and members of the committee, I'm Ellen Lowe, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Food Bank and their regional network and over 800 agencies. And you've been hearing from all the certified smart people involved actually in healthcare. What I'm here today to say is that too often the place that people come asking questions, seeking direction of where they might go for a variety of services, but often healthcare, happens to be at that local pantry or the soup kitchen because they feel at ease there and they begin to share. And so I'm here today in support on their behalf of 3250 to provide some assistance to the development of collaboratives at the local level so that we really can do something about our delivery system so it becomes more responsive to the kind of folks who are the ones that we so often serve. And so we often are that information and referral agency. We believe that collaboratives have the potential to provide us timely information so we in turn can provide it to the people who come to us. And what we've been seeing beginning in Lane County and also in Multnomah County, and as our good friend Mike Bonetto described what's happening over there, the ultimate beneficiaries are going to be the people who need help. And so we encourage you to provide some assistance for the development of collaboratives all across the state, because what you will soon be doing downstairs in 50 is providing a statewide framework, but let's make sure that it allows for some local direction.
Thank you. Have you been a part, you being Food Bank, been a part of the 211 network?
Chair Greenlich, yes. And in the last session, all we were able to manage was to have the state of Oregon become the designee, so that if indeed any federal funds ever occurred, we would be able to receive them. But there is a remarkable network that has been put together in Multnomah County. There's some things being done down in Representative Richardson's county, and that is one of the really important things where the state of Oregon ought to become involved, because among other things, then you can have redundancy from one area to the other. So if you ever had an earthquake in Medford, then the system that in Portland would be able to respond, or vice versa, or floods, or 2-1-1 works in the state of Oregon.
An expansion of 2-1-1 to this problem might be.
Yes, and if it 2-1-1 is the best way of bringing together all the information that responds to those who weren't sitting in the back looking at the Oregon Blue Book.
Any other questions? Be nice. Grant?
Chair Greenlee, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson. I am the administrator of the Office of Community Health and Health Planning, State Public Health Division, Department of Human Services, and I'm here to provide information on House Bill 3250, which, as you know, would create a grant program for community collaboration health access initiatives, and that program would be administered by the Department of Human Services. This bill does have a fiscal impact. It is not in the governor's budget, so I cannot outright support it. However, we do like a number of things about the bill, and I will try to be very brief because things have been said pretty much already. Three things that I really like about the bill. One is, as you've heard before, this is going beyond looking at medical services financing reform and really looking at health care systems delivery reform, which I think we need to do if we're going to hope to change the outcomes that we want to see and improve in health status. The second thing that you've already heard is that I don't think that we can rely on the federal government to give us a magic bullet for how we're going to fix the health care delivery system. What we need to do is incent local communities to come up with innovative ideas that they can implement, and we can see what really works at the local level. And then the third thing that you haven't heard already is that I see this as a real opportunity to get some public health principles incorporated into the health care delivery services. And what I'm thinking of there are things like outreach to vulnerable populations, providing culturally competent services, promoting the prevention and wellness services, providing and utilizing a comprehensive care model, using the assessment of the health status and disparities in your service population in helping you determine what kind of services and how to provide services in your community, and then developing referral and tracking systems to make sure people are getting the services that you're trying to provide. And as other people, and as other people have already mentioned, evaluation, I think, is an important component in whatever program we're doing to make sure that we're being effective at these pilots that we're getting out to local communities. And with that, I'll close. Be happy to answer questions.
Chair Greenlee and members of the committee, I'm Jim Edge. I'm the interim administrator of the Division of Medical Assistance Programs in the Department of Human Services. I'm here to talk about House Bill 2850. Wanted to just mention first that the department is fully supportive of children and health care for children and health care access for children. But Representative Maurer gave part of my testimony already when he said the department is going to find a large fiscal in this bill, fiscal that's not in the governor's recommended budget. And that is true. And just real quickly to mention the major components that make up that fiscal, there's a component in the bill that talks about a presumption of eligibility. Services would be provided to children who are not yet enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan, and to the extent that some of those children would never become enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan or would be found not eligible, those services then would have to be provided entirely with general funds, and there's certainly a cost to that. There's a component of the bill that could require double payments in that we make capitation payments to managed care plans. And the way the bill is currently structured, it would require fee-for-service payments for those same services, some of those same services anyway. And there's a third component that that raised our concern, and that's the fact that the prioritized list of health services, one of the basic tenets of the Oregon Health Plan, generally applies to services provided through the Oregon Health Plan. The bill, as currently written, would cover all services, not just those services above the line on the prioritized list of health services. So, as currently written, the bill does have a large fiscal and isn't in the governor's recommended budget. But I will add to that that I'm hearing today that there's going to be changes to the bill, maybe bills combined. We're hearing about the possibility of public health nursing services being included in this and possibly components of the Babies First program. We're certainly willing to work with all of the ideas as those changes happen and reevaluate and reexamine and come up with a new fiscal when that happens.
Would that be covered in the governor's budget if this basically was written into 2201 and 2201 passed? With the requirement that these services be paid for out of the capitation for capitated kids. Would that be then covered in the tobacco tax in the governor's budget?
That would require a new analysis of exactly what services are in the bill once it gets rewritten and whether they are part of the covered services under the Oregon Health Plan in the prioritized list. So we'll do that evaluation as soon as...
Kids, eh? Good. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Any questions? You've beaten us into submission.
You're downstairs.
Before we leave, and we do need to get downstairs, we had House Joint Resolution 18 on the agenda, forgetting that we had already passed it on to the full committee. But Representative Richardson has an amendment that we'll take up on Friday in discussion, but I thought he might... We might take a couple of minutes to introduce it for the record right now. Oh, wait a minute. Okay. A gavel to close the informational meeting that related to home care pilot projects. I'll close the public hearing on HB 2850. I'll close the public hearing on HB 3250. And we'll just do this under the good of the order in our general committee business.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In looking closely at House Joint Resolution 18 and assuming that it's going to make it to the ballot, the question is what would make this more palatable and appropriate for the largest number of Oregonians so they would feel comfortable in seriously considering a constitutional amendment to provide health care as an essential safeguard of human life and dignity. And it's felt by many that the concern is that this could be interpreted by, if it was passed, that we'd ultimately just we have a single-payer socialized medicine system or model, which is not the intention of the resolution.
Yes, and I can state that for the record. That is absolutely not the intention of the resolution.
And so the proposed amendment would add to it a sentence which would say, a plan adopted by the Legislative Assembly under this section may not limit the right of residents to purchase their own health care coverage or health care, which would basically clarify for the legislature in implementing House Joint Resolution 18, if it were voted and passed by the people, that there should always be the opportunity for citizens to purchase their own coverage and to buy up if they choose to.
Great, and we'll discuss that at the hearing on Friday, at the full committee hearing. Do you have an extra copy of that?
Yes.
Thank you. Let me have one. Well, thank you all very much for helping me. This was a great session. I'm sorry that it went to schedule 2 hours. I'm sorry it started 30 minutes late. I really appreciate those of you that came from a long way to help inform us. And I think the ideas that are in these bills are very precious to a lot of us. And it would be very useful. I mean, I learned from my colleague here and from some of his colleagues in when we were busy discussing 2201, that the issue is not solved automatically by giving everybody a health insurance card. No. that the problem is, even if downstairs we succeed in creating a universal access model, it will be years in coming to fruition if all goes well. And in the meantime, we'll have, and even if Healthy Kids pass, we will end up having 475,000 adults without access to health care, and probably lots of those kids without access to health care, even if it passed quickly, because it's going to take time to get them in, and that we need to be doing something to organize a healthcare system that can help take care of this problem, at least get a good head start on it. So that's where we hope we can go. I wish the work group luck. It's a tough problem, and I adjourn the subcommittee on healthcare access of the House Committee on Healthcare.